Hello, and welcome to episode 204 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics in modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
One of the topics that seems to come up often, whether at work, online, or even in our personal lives, is feedback. And yet so much of the feedback people receive today feels vague, performative, or even cruel. In preparing for today's conversation, we came across a couple of articles that get at the heart of this. How formal feedback, like workplace performance reviews, can sometimes do more harm than good, and what it takes to make feedback meaningful and constructive. So, Rick, do you think we are often giving feedback all wrong, and what would it take to improve on this pretty critical thing?
I know we're giving feedback all wrong, and you can do that. You just look at the studies of how many people hate performance reviews, why so many companies are trying to find different methods of evaluating employees. And how we can do it better is really investing in teaching people how to coach. And in workplaces, we just do not do a good job of teaching managers how to manage people. And a lot of that is how to coach people.
And there is sort of a through line, right, between sort of three things like training and then coaching. So, I mean, training, you know, here's how we should be doing things. And so that's like step one of a job, right? And then step two is sort of coaching people who might not instinctively figure it out right away. And then where does feedback, is that sort of at the close of that loop, or is that sort of oversimplifying it?
Well, I think feedback fits into what I would call coaching. And good coaching is you're always giving feedback. You're always observing. You're evaluating, and then you're giving advice like, here's what I'm seeing. Here's what you could do better. What do you think? And it's a two-way conversation. Good feedback is never just one way. It's always two-way.
And many years ago, I was having a performance review for a particular job, and I think my boss was maybe could get the sense that I was a little, you know, anxious or, you know, unsure about how it was going to go. And I think what he told me, and it really is the right answer. He says, don't worry. If there were a problem, you'd already know. And in some ways, that's right. I mean, you should never walk into these, if these are like annual reviews, and be like surprised. I mean, good or bad, right? I mean, if somebody says, Rick, you're the best employee we've ever had around here, well, you should be hearing that once a year.
Right.
And obviously, if it's the other side where you're, you know, have like fault after fault after fault, well, again, you shouldn't be hearing that once a year.
My experience, and so many people I've talked to that have undergone, you know, like the annual performance review process, has been kind of puzzled by it. Like, what's the real purpose of this? If the purpose is to improve performance, then you can't just do it on an annual basis of go through a whole list of things that you've done all year long and expect improvement in performance out of that. So it's kind of from an organizational standpoint, it's good for record keeping. So you kind of at least an annual record. But I would think that in that case, if you're really doing that well, both the supervisor and the employee would already know everything that's going into it because they're having regular conversations. They're having regular updates and two-way conversations about what's going well and what isn't, what needs to be improved.
So you're not surprised?
You shouldn't be.
Yeah.
A surprise indicates a failure of the whole process. But the fact that so many people are anxious going into these performance evaluations indicates that it really is a surprise. They don't really know. And when you have a conversation with somebody you know really well, you are not often surprised by what they say because any conversation is part of an ongoing conversation.
Yeah, this is just sort of the documented version of that.
Yeah. And if you've ever been in sports and you've had a really good coach, your coach doesn't like once a month or once a year come and spring on you a whole bunch of surprises about, here's what I really think about how you're doing. It's like you're getting feedback every day. This is what good coaches do.
It was funny. I was actually on the way over here to record the podcast today. I was listening to MLB Network Radio, and we're recording this the day, actually, of the All-Star Game, which is in Atlanta, Georgia this year. And by the time you listen to this, it's going to be like a week later. But nonetheless, they were interviewing a lot of Atlanta Braves players from the past. And Chipper Jones, who was an All-Star or Hall of Fame third baseman for the Braves for many years.
For a long time.
Long time, I think. I believe with the Braves exclusively, was talking, and I only heard, it was a long interview, and I have a short drive, so I only heard a small part of it. But what stuck out with me during that was that he was, I get the sense, I missed sort of the setup, but I think it was early in his career, he was at a spring training facility, and he was a very successful, Chipper Jones was a very successful college player, and I'm sure he was always the best player on his team, wherever he was. And he was at the spring training, maybe the first year with the Atlanta Braves. And he said he still remembers the conversation he had with the coach on the team at the time, Don Baylor, who was another longtime major league player and coach. Baylor was watching Jones in the hitter's cage, just take a few pitches and maybe swung 10 times and then was going to walk away. And Baylor's like, where are you going? And he's like, well, somebody else needs a turn. He's like, no, I want you to stay in there because here's the three things you're not doing right, and we need to work on this. And then, so he took 10 more swings, and he's like, well, there, how's that? And he's like, no, we're going to keep at this. And what really what stuck out in Chipper Jones' mind about this is he'd never been talked to quite that way before because he'd always been looked at as just this sort of wonder kid. What made me think of this entire conversation is the line Chipper said during this interview. He said, I really liked that.
Yeah.
He really liked that somebody cared enough to say, hey, I see a problem in your swing and we're going to work on that and fix that. Because I think, and he had also gotten to the level where you have the coaching staff and the expertise to address those things. I mean, that's also a key part of this. But I think that coaches or managers often don't realize that some of their best performers and maybe some of the ones who are struggling often do want that feedback.
So you mentioned two things that are really important when it comes to good feedback. One is you have to have a coach or a manager who really knows what they're doing, who knows what to look for and can actually give good advice. And you can never guarantee that by a process. So it doesn't matter how good of a performance evaluation process you have in an organization. If you have people that don't really know what they're looking for and don't know how to communicate it, that process is flawed, right? So you need very good managers to give good feedback. That's why I started out talking about, like, you need to teach people how to coach. The second thing is it has to be constructive. And constructive doesn't mean it's positive, right? It just that it meaningfully helps a person identify what they can do to get better at something. And most people really want constructive feedback. Most people want to do their jobs well. And if you can give them good advice and how they can do it better, they're really receptive to it. And that doesn't involve telling somebody that they're really bad at what they do. It just involves saying, like, well, I've noticed this. And Don Baylor was really specific. I know it's three things that you can do better.
In your swing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is another problem that I have with all kinds of feedback and performance evaluations that say have 20 items on it. Like you're not going to cover 20 items.
Yeah.
Right? You sit down, you have to be able to really pinpoint, like, what are the things you really need to work on to improve in this certain area or this certain respect, and then just focus on that. And if you watch really good coaches in any sport, that's what they do. They observe their players and they say, okay, I want you to work on this. In basketball, it might be a passing drill, it might be a shooting drill, it might be free throws, it might be footwork if they play in the post. You know, in baseball, it could be on fielding or defense, it could be batting. But there's very specific things to work on, right? And when I've been through this evaluation performance evaluation process, it's like rank yourself on a scale to, you know, 1 to 5 on how you did in a certain area. Like the ranking process is just meaningless. That doesn't tell me anything about what I need to work on.
And I remember talking with a friend a couple of years ago, and he works clearly for a whole different line of work than I'm in. But I was saying, you know, how are things at work, or just sort of, you know, an open-ended question. He says, oh, you don't realize this is the worst, you know, 3-week period of the year. I'm like, oh, why is that? He said, well, I have like 15 direct reports, and this 2 or 3 week period of the year is when I have to write all of their evaluations. And I thought, and I've worked for companies where it's not set up that way. And I don't know what's more common, but I've worked for companies where, Rick, if you were hired in May, and then every May is when we have your performance review. And then if your colleague was hired in September, well, then that's when her performance review is every September. And I think the good thing about that is you aren't like my friend was, having this, you know, 3 week thing where you're just doing almost nothing but writing these. And I just can't believe that that is anything but just a slog for him to get through. And I worry, or maybe not worry because it doesn't really affect me, but wonder if it's like the best way to do that whole process.
Yeah, I remember the first time that I had to do this. I was only in my second year of teaching, and I was appointed as a department chair. And for kind of a really odd set of circumstances, we had a 6-member department. I ended up being the most junior person, and I knew how to call meetings, you know, and to do that sort of thing. But then, like, we go through the whole year, and then my dean tells me, oh, now you need to turn in an evaluation of all the faculty. And I received, you know, all their student evaluations, all, you know, how they're ranked by students and comments from students. And I'm supposed to take all that information and then meet with each faculty member and then give them a score. I'm the most inexperienced person here. There's no way I'm qualified to do this, but it was mandatory, right? So I remember, like, the most uncomfortable conversation was I had a 70-year-old faculty member who had been teaching for 50 years, had been a pretty good teacher. That year, he tried some new things in some courses, had a couple courses where he was really struggling. The evaluations weren't good at all. And I'm supposed to go in and evaluate him. And it is ridiculous.
And I'm sure that you felt uncomfortable, and he must have not. I mean, how did he take this when you walked in and started the conversation?
Well, I just walked in. I said, Jim, this is really uncomfortable. I don't know how I'm supposed to do this. You know more about teaching than I could ever know. But I have to write up this evaluation of you. So let's do it together. And we just proceeded. And he was very good natured about it. And I learned a lot from him. Ended up having a really good conversation about the nature of teaching, how hard it is, how you plan a course, it doesn't always go the way you want. Sometimes you can change things, you know, kind of a mid-course correction. Sometimes you can't because you've chosen the wrong textbooks or something, whatever it happens to be. He had a really wonderful attitude about teaching. And so that ended up being a very good experience for me, but it also showed me kind of the nonsensical nature of having a process where it's perfunctory. It's a formality to fill out these forms. Also, somebody who really wasn't qualified to do it was put in the position of having to do it.
But these were based, you said, on the evaluation students submitted at the end of the semester. Is that right?
That was part of the evaluation.
So just to stick on that for a second, you've been in a professor for a long time. Are those truly useful, those feedback from students? Because, you know, not all feedback forms, I'm sure, are created equally. But in the grand scope, have those been, is that a useful thing that universities still do?
Yes and no. They're useful in identifying if there's student faculty members that are really doing an awful job, right? And you have a number of students saying that they aren't learning anything from the class, and that's a pretty consistent finding, then you know you've got a real problem. But you can also have faculty members who get really high scores on teaching evaluations because they really like, they've got a professor who's very funny in the class, very personable, engaging, but they're actually not learning very much. Yeah. They're just very entertained in the class, and that person can get really high marks. And you can also have faculty members that are like really challenging their students. Students are learning a great deal, but they're not necessarily enjoying the course. And that kind of faculty member won't tend to get the really high scores. However, you have to really pay attention to how the students are evaluating. And if they say that they're learning things from the course, that's like a really significant marker.
I want to move on from performance reviews in just a second, but I just had to tell this story because I often think of this story when people mention performance reviews. This was many years ago, and we had this software we were given to, and I think before that, if I'm not mistaken, like you wrote them out by hand, and now we had like some HR software where you typed in these little modules. So you do all that and you enter all the information. And then at the very end, there were two things you were supposed to do. Run a spell check, which is a good thing to do. You know, we can all make mistakes. So you ran a spell check and make sure everything was fine. And then it had what was called a language check. And I swear every time this happened to me, because no matter what line of work you're in, the word project is probably going to show up. Like Rick took on a couple new projects this year and did a great job. Every time it suggested I substitute the word or take out the word project and use low-income housing. And I was just like, what did they think where I'd be writing? Like, Susan shows up for the projects every day without fail. I don't even know how that would like come up.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like every time I just had to chuckle when I clicked through the language check and it told me that project was not a word I should be using.
I think we're going to see the same thing happen with AIs. Like there's going to be in these early years of using it, there's going to be all these really obvious errors, right, that keep coming up in the early years of using computers to do these kinds of evaluations. I remember somebody telling me about how like he'd been performing kind of middle of the range, like not impressing his bosses and things at his job very much. Then they had these new evaluations where you had to set your goals for the year. And then you were measured against the goal, and then it gave you a numerical rating. And he scored perfect on all this, and his bosses were really pleased about how much better he'd done over the past year and so forth. And he just said, I just set goals that I like. That were really easy.
Yeah.
So I made sure I could make them. And they were just looking at the numbers. They weren't looking at anything else. Right. And like, but of course that didn't last for very long. This was in the early days of trying to quantify everything in easy to measure ways.
So feedback obviously is important in the workplace, but it's also important in just our everyday lives. And maybe we kind of talk about it, call that advice instead of feedback, but there was an article, and we'll certainly link to it, that Jason Pfeiffer wrote about how to give good feedback, both at work and otherwise. But he wrote, and I think there's some truth to this, that, quote, nobody truly seeks advice. They just seek confirmation. And I've caught myself doing this sometimes. Like if I think I've put together a really good report or a good presentation on something, I'll be maybe occasionally tempted to share it with somebody like, hey, what do you think of this? You think this turned out okay? Because I'm expecting like a little attaboy, you know, like, oh, that was great. Good job, Scott. You know, I think there are times where we do that just to get like the confirmation that, yeah, we thought we did a good job and, well, we really did.
I think we go to different people for different kinds of responses.
Yeah.
I think sometimes we go to people, if we just want praise, if we just want confirmation, we'll tell somebody about what we're doing. We go to other people because we know they're going to be honest with us and they're going to help us.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Right.
Again, whether this is work or in our personal lives, right?
Yeah. I know when I'm when I'm really struggling with a piece of writing that I'm serious about and I want it to be good and I'm just not sure about what I'm doing, there's an old friend I go to, somebody I went to grad school with, and I don't talk to him very often, but we've been friends for a long time. I know he'll be quite critical with me. If he praises it, it's because he sincerely thinks it's really good. But if he thinks there's something wrong with it, there really is something wrong with it, and I have to change it if I want to get better. And that's why I go to him, because I know that nobody has quite the critical eye that he does. So I think that's where I'm taking that.
Yeah,
from.
Like
if we're working on something that we really care about the end result, right? Then we want the kind of feedback that's going to help us make it better.
Anyway, and I think what Jason sort of unpacks in the article that he says, and kind of like you do, that we sort of need different people and different types of feedback at different points of a project. And he kind of sorts them into three buckets, calls them early collaborators, reactors in the middle, and refiners at the end. And I guess, and I think that's probably true, but I find for me that I very much want the collaborators at the beginning to kind of make sure I'm headed in the right direction. Or have we really thought this through? Do we really want to do X, Y, and Z? Or do we want to just think about this entirely differently and do A, B, and C? And that is where I really, for me, and I think maybe for me, it might go both ways, right? Where I'm much better at sort of providing that feedback or soliciting that feedback early in the process, because I suppose like a lot of people, you don't want to spend hours and hours or days and days on something and realize that this went in the entirely wrong direction. And that was just, time misspent.
Right. Yeah. And as soon as you said that, I was saying, I have a couple of people in mind that I'll go to at the beginning stages of an idea. I'm thinking about a new project or something, and I want to just toss ideas out with them, and they're really good at tossing other ideas back or, and telling me what they think. But just at that initial stage, mm-hmm. right, of collaboration, is that what this?
Yeah. Early collaborators.
Yeah. These are different kinds of talents, like the early collaboration, that kind of that brainstorming, tossing ideas around. That's a very different kind of talent than somebody who's a refiner.
Yes.
Who's going to help you polish something at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, depending on where you are in the stage of different projects, you're going to go to different people.
Whether it's your personal or professional life, constructive feedback or critical feedback, should it hurt, right? That's the tough part. I think that's the thing where some people hesitate to be that critical voice, because if they know somebody spent like a week on this and they think it's not very good, there are some people whose instinctive reaction is going to be kind of to either say nothing or sort of soft pedal the criticism because they don't want to hurt that person. And maybe that's why they're not, as was what Jason would call them, a great refiner at the end.
Yeah. So this is really tough. And this is where I think if you are the person who's giving the feedback, you have to exercise some judgment in knowing the person you're talking to, how they receive criticism, whether they want you just to, if they're doing something wrong, if they want you to be brutally honest, and they're going to respond to that with more energy and that's going to motivate them, or if it's just going to completely demoralize and shut them down. It takes a little sensitivity and nuance, kind of understanding something about the person. There's times where feedback should hurt. Like if you're really messing up and you're not listening, well, the feedback might have to hurt to get your attention. I mean, parents do this.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in some ways, raising children is just a perpetual feedback loop, right?
It is. And sometimes they're not listening and they're doing things that could be dangerous to themselves or to others. And punishment is a form of feedback. But there's other times where you need a very gentle approach, and it's kind of gentle advice or encouragement. There's different approaches to different situations, and then dealing with different people.
We all have phrases that we don't like for any number of reasons. And I don't know if you have any that come to mind, but I sure have one that I don't like. And you'll see this a lot. Social media is one place, but that's just where I see it a lot. But I'm sure it happens, as the kids say, IRL, or in real life, where, you know, I'll use a social media example, but then I'll talk through why I don't like it. But let's say somebody posts, it doesn't always have to be a terribly maudlin thing, but about how maybe they're just going through a tough patch in life, and, you know, they're just wanting to let folks know that here's what they're facing, and they think that there's going to be some solutions, but the next few weeks are going to be a little hard, so just kind of putting it out there. And then this is like kind of a newer phrase, maybe, I don't know, I just don't like it, is you'll have like 17 people below say, "You got this." And I just like, and it's just, I mean, A, they may not. And B, you could also, the word got, or the verb got, is just like one of my least favorite verbs. That's probably where a lot of this comes from. But I also think like it's just not useful. And I think people are trying to be like, you know, kind of cheering them on, like, "Oh, you're going to be fine. You're going to overcome this moment of this low point in your life." And I know I know that it's probably coming from a better place than I think. But And I'm sure you've heard people say that, like, if people are having like, "Oh, I'm having a real tough talk with my boss tomorrow. I'm going to ask for a raise, and I don't know if it's going to go well." "Oh, you got this." I mean, that's like the ultimate useless feedback, right?
Well, it's like, what do you expect from social media, right? Because what oftentimes is called for in that situation is like a real conversation,
where you get
a little more indication of what's going on, and then you say, "Look, I understand you're really worried, but you've been doing a great job. I don't think you have anything to be concerned about. Like, go in with confidence because it's okay."
I just worry though that people who say things like that are just like not doing anything. They think they're being helpful and they're just not. Or, and I guess maybe the more important point to me is that they're like, that like just those three words, like somebody like kind of pours their heart out and they're like, "Yeah, you got it. It's fine. Don't worry about it." And like, they've just like told you like, well, they're facing all these like really serious challenges.
Told you exactly why they are worried.
Yeah. And I just feel like it's dismissive. Maybe that's the word I'm looking for here.
Yeah.
And I just think that's like the worst thing you can say when people are...
It's not genuine feedback.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It's not genuine.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with that. You know, I'll go back to another experience I had. I told you about my second year of teaching. I was a department chair. My first year, I was teaching in a college that had a fairly large department, and they were really well organized, and there were three of us starting that year, and we were each assigned a mentor. That's a senior faculty member that we had to meet with weekly to talk about how things were going, how our teaching was going. The person that I was assigned to was a terrible teacher. He was the worst teacher in the department. He'd been there a long time and he'd gotten really cynical and I think really lazy. He just didn't care about his teaching. And he would say meaningless things to me like that, like, "You got this." It's like, and I wanted like real advice.
Yeah, so
there were some things I thought I was doing well. There's other things I was really struggling with. And this goes to another thing about feedback. And one of the things I don't like about the performance review stuff, we all need mentors in our life, especially if we want to get better in our life generally, especially in our professional careers. You need mentors. You need somebody with experience who you can go to and you can talk about, like, "This is what's going on. And could you help me think through this or figure out what to do next or give me some advice?" To get really good, honest feedback, you need a mentor. In good mentor relationships, people always choose their own mentor. Like, it can't be somebody who's just assigned to you.
Yeah.
Because You generally have a good sense of who are the people whose advice you trust, who are going to be honest with you, and who are going to say things that are really useful. When you go on social media and you tell a whole bunch of people, this is what I'm really struggling with, you can't really be serious about seeking good advice anyway. So it's no surprise, like, you're making basically a meaningless gesture. You're going to get meaningless phrases back. But you should have somebody in your life that you can go to and you can really talk through those things and get, like, some good constructive feedback from.
Well, and here's maybe where I want to end the conversation then. So let's say you know someone who has a lot of challenges in his life, and he will often come to you with, like, sincerely wanting to talk to you about these things, and you're patient and you listen, and he will, like, seems to sincerely ask you for advice, and you are pretty confident that the advice you're giving based on your experience is sound, solid advice. And in fact, you're even more confident that it's good advice because time and time again, he doesn't listen to your advice and the problems don't get better or maybe even get worse, but he still continuously comes to you for advice and continuously doesn't follow it. What do you do in a situation like that where you just see a person sort of making the same mistakes but still asking for feedback?
I'm not going to give it a lot more thought. I mean, I might speculate on why the person keeps doing this kind of behavior. Depending on who it is and some more information about the context, I might even bring that very point up. But I'm not going to keep, it's hard to give good feedback. You have to listen to somebody really carefully. You have to really pay attention. You have to imagine what they're going through, what's going on in the situation. And it's energy, like any kind of, like, constructive work. Trying to get better at something requires energy. Helping somebody else get better at something requires energy. And if that energy isn't repaid somehow, if it's not even appreciated or acknowledged, I'm not going to put any more effort into that. So I'm probably just going to say, listen politely and say, well, I just don't know what to tell you. I'm sorry, you got me stumped here.
But you would never come and say, well, the last four times we've talked and I've given you advice and you haven't followed it, so I'm just sort of tired of this? Or would you would it be quite that direct?
Well, I wouldn't put it in those words, but I might be that direct. I might say something like, I've just noticed that, like, a couple of the times you come to me for advice and I've suggested something you hadn't followed it. So I'm not sure why you're asking me. Like, what do you really want here?
Maybe he hopes one day to get what we talked about earlier.
Confirmation
that and you just he hasn't quite gotten it yet.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, or prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, I hear you have one for me.
Yeah, Scott. So this is based on a true story. Something had happened just recently. Let's say an old friend calls you up and he says he's traveling across the country on a road trip and will be coming through your town the next day. He wants to know if he can stay overnight and spend a little time catching up. And you say, sure. The day arrives and he calls in the evening saying he's stuck in road construction and won't arrive until late that night. He eventually shows up just before midnight. He's dead tired and wants to go to bed right away, but says he'd like to sleep in and then have a leisurely breakfast and visit for a couple hours before he heads out in the morning. The problem is you have a full day of work planned, including several meetings beginning early in the morning. What do you do?
I don't know if you know this about me or not. I think we're in agreement on this. I have very little patience, and probably this has caused me problems at times with people who are not genuinely reliable or punctual. And for example, we meet and record this podcast at 4 o'clock. I have not gone back and looked, but I think, like, if I did, I would be quite confident that you arrive within 3 minutes either side of 4 o'clock just about every time. So to me, that is great, because if you were constantly like 20, 25 minutes late, I would grow tired of that pretty quickly. And I think, and this is a more professional setting, but I also don't have a lot of patience or understanding, maybe sometimes, of people. And obviously, there's clearly going to be exceptions, like, you know, of course there are. But like in this case that you outline, it sounds like this was like a multi-hour delay, right?
Yeah.
Like maybe 4, 5, 6 hour delay.
Yeah.
And we've all, I've been in stuck in, you know, I've.
And it wasn't that person's fault. They were.
Well, I don't know. Because I've been stuck in traffic delays, and we've all had road construction issues. Two things are true, I think. I mean, one, if it truly is that bad, you can usually get an alert on your phone and it may redirect you. But I've never been stuck in traffic that's delayed me like 6 hours. It just has never happened. And I would be like kind of skeptical that this is really a true story. And I mean, like, I often think to myself, like, there's a particular person or two in my life who's like perpetually late for everything we do. And I always think to myself, you know, if I told you, like, I'm going to give you $1,000 if you show up on time, I'm sure that person would find a way to show up on time. So it's like a choice, right? And that's just how I look at it. And like, you know, clearly, if this were important enough, like $1,000, it would be a priority. And when people are like consistently late, it, to me, it just says you don't care that much about me, and that's fine, but I'm not going to go out of my way to care about you. So I don't know, maybe I'm reading more into this than I should in this case, but if I were in your shoes, part of me would be like, how in the world, I don't know how I would say this, but like, how in the world can you be like 5 or 6 hours late no matter where you're coming from? It just seems weird to me. That's probably not your question, but that would be my first thought. Secondly, would I upend my day the next day to spend time with this person? I can't think of, I mean, this is a person presumably you've not seen in a long time.
Yeah.
And if you've not seen the person in a long time, I mean, you're probably not ridiculously close to the person, but I'm sure you'd appreciate seeing him or her. So I guess I would be very honest and say, you know, obviously because of your late arrival last night, that didn't work out. And today, I have meetings and other commitments from 8 until 3 p.m. But, you know, since your schedule seems to be fairly fungible, if you're still around at 3 o'clock, I'd be happy to have an early dinner or go out for a drink or meet up on the patio or do whatever you'd like. But I don't think I would upend my day to accommodate someone who does not seem to be terribly respectful of my schedule.
Yeah. And that makes sense. And you would assume like either the person like just didn't hurry, just didn't take care to make sure they're on time, didn't care enough to take those kinds of precautions, or they just gave you a really poor estimate of when they would be arriving.
And, yeah. Which I mean,
also isn't very considerate.
And also the days of like not knowing when you're going to be somewhere are sort of like, that's like 1999. I mean, we've kind of gotten past that now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's interesting. And so I like your response of saying, I'd be happy to like visit with you in the afternoon or the evening if you want to be, and then put the burden back on them.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones who cause the inconvenience. They, instead of inconveniencing you in return, if they want to have some more inconvenience, that they could incur that themselves, and then you'd make time to visit with them.
Are you more patient? And probably the answer is yes, but are you more patient than I am for people who are habitually late?
No, I'm not very patient for people who are habitually late. And I know some, and I've got some friends that are, and I let them know, but I also like kind of after a time, what you do is you kind of build it into your estimation.
Yeah.
So like my brother, when he's traveling, we're seeing each other from distances, he always is 1 to 2 hours late when he's driving. So I just assume like when he says he's going to be here at 2, it's going to be 3 to 4. Mm-hmm. And that's usually about right. So.
But is it wrong of me to like think of this as using my $1,000 example? If you told your brother, if you're there at 2 o'clock, I'm giving you $1,000. You know, he probably would be there at 2 o'clock, right?
I kind of doubt it.
$10,000. There has to be some motivating factor.
There's some motivating factor.
Yeah. So I guess how I look at that then is that whatever that motivating factor is to get him there on time is not the same motive, but just seeing me and being respectful of my time and just sort of, you know, life is not a big enough motivating factor, because we've determined there is something that is big enough to motivate you, but it ain't just me. And that's what I guess I can't get past.
Yeah. Yeah. It isn't you, or it isn't the occasion. Like lots of times when we're getting together, so we're getting together for a family holiday or something.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it's not like you're missing turkey dinner.
Right. Yeah. He's going to get there before the turkey is carved.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's different when you have somebody who's habitually late than for the real consequential things, or is regularly inconveniencing others. And I think you've answered my dilemma. When I preface this by saying this based on a real case, it's even more interesting than, like, I was kind of speculating on what would I have done in this case if I had a lot of meetings scheduled. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I happened to have a morning that was pretty free, but also this was a visit from an old friend who was a former student of mine, who now has a very large family. Nine kids.
Oh, my goodness.
11 people traveling in a van.
That's a big van.
They have no smartphones.
Really?
Yeah, and they got stuck in Chicago traffic in a really bad traffic jam.
Okay.
And they were relying on a GPS built into the car, but the GPS kept trying to route them back
into the
road construction. And they were completely stopped for about an hour. They managed to get ahead and then move off. They ended up driving through Chicago city streets,
okay,
instead of the interstate.
Which would slow you down.
Which would slow them down and slowed them down quite a bit. Here it was really refreshing to have this family arrive there, ages 1 to 17 years old.
Wow. And they stayed with you?
They stayed in our house.
My goodness.
Like we got out some spare mattresses and, you know, like sleeping bags on the floor and that sort of thing.
Wow.
And they arrived very late. We made dinner for them late that evening.
A big dinner, obviously.
Yeah. They were so polite and respectful. They were all very kind. And it was so cool to see a large family with really well-behaved children. And then they kind of had a leisurely breakfast. We visited in the morning, and the kids played together and looked out for one another. And it was kind of like moving all around. It was an amazing thing to see, and the sort of thing that I haven't seen since I was a child. We just don't see large families like this anymore, all with children who are able to entertain themselves without electric devices.
Well, and that's what kind of I thought of is, at first you're saying that they're this very kind and caring family. And then my first thought was, well, if they were kind and caring, they would have had been able to call you on the cell phone and say, hey, Rick, we're running 4 hours late.
Because, oh, they did.
Well, but I mean, yeah, they had to stop the car and go somewhere, right?
No.
Or they had a phone, but not a smartphone.
They had a flip phone, but not a smartphone. Okay. So they didn't have the advantage of GPS telling them.
Okay, but they could at least call and let you know that. So
they called, and so we had regular updates. But then we knew they were coming.
But then, again, back to what I think probably you were just saying, is if they had, you know, just a flip phone without a smartphone, obviously none of the kids had smartphones, and it does seem to change the family dynamic, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable. We had some of the boys in the morning making paper airplanes and flying them down the staircase, you know, that sort of thing. It was
like 1954 at the Kite household.
It was really cool.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And also, be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and that can be found on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.